This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I think we can all agree that this has been a wonderful occasion so far, an extremely rich morning. Lots of issues raised, lots of substance discussed, and we are now about to enter the afternoon. I'm talking for a few more minutes just to talk while things settle. An afternoon that promises, I think, to be almost as rich as the morning. To begin the afternoon, let me welcome you back. My name is Dean Jameson. I'm here at UCSF again as a senior fellow in global health sciences, and delighted to be back, delighted to be able to participate in this wonderful symposium. This afternoon's first discussion is on finance, on directions for, in particular, development assistance finance. And we have posed the question of the implications for international finance, for collective global finance, of one of the main conclusions of the Commission on Investing in Health that Jaime referred to this morning. The chair of that commission, Larry Summers, has, let me say, I think, an unusually hopeful and optimistic view of where the world is and where it's going. I found it sometimes hard to keep up with his optimism. An important facet of his optimism concerns continued economic growth in the low and middle income countries. And one of the things that the Commission on Investing in Health did was a 20-year projection to 2035 of what economic growth would likely look like. Now, I think we can all appreciate the huge uncertainties in such an enterprise, but we made a stab at that. Under any reasonable set of assumptions, though, barring major catastrophes possible, the resources available to most but not all of the low and middle income countries will increase quite markedly in the coming 20 years. That means the resources that they have to finance maternal and child health, control of AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, other facets of their health system, if they so choose, will increase markedly. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has documented in its work on trends in global development assistance for health. That's now runs at about $30 billion a year. That's a huge increase from where it was 15 years ago. On the other hand, times are tight in the high-income countries. That amount isn't projected to increase. I think Chris's conclusion is that it's not now decreasing, which is, in the circumstances, I think, good news. But we don't expect major increases. But we do, if Larry Summers is right, see a major possibility for substitution of national resources for global resources. Those global resources can go in a number of different directions toward global public goods. Today we have, for this brief session, two institutional leaders and two intellectual leaders who are concerned with the global public goods aspect of development finance. And I'll turn first to Peter Singer, who's the chief executive of Grand Challenges in Canada, then to Roger Glass from the US NIH, head of the Fogarty Center and assistant director of NIH for global or international affairs. So they bring two very different institutional perspectives on both the need for resources spent at the global level, how those resources are evolving, and how they might best be used. So I think that will be the direction of our conversation this afternoon. And with that, I'll turn to you.
Well, Peter. Thank you very much, Dean. I mean, the first thing is, I think if we're having a fireside chat, is there any way to get the fireplace channel up on the thing behind? It's like my favorite channel. And seriously, to Jaime and Haile, what a great honor it is. And this crowd here is a testament to your fine work, and it's such a huge privilege to be here in celebration for all you've accomplished. So thank you very much. Third point is I'm actually changing my name for the tweeters in the room to @PeterASinger. So if you recognize that name change, that'd be great. So this is a huge topic, and so obviously in 12 minutes, Roger and I can't cover all of it. I want to go in with a very specific lens, and that's the lens of innovation. So first point, as Dean mentioned, development assistance for health, according to Chris and his colleagues, is about $31 billion. That's mostly G8 or OECD countries, development finance institutions, NGOs, and of course foundations. And the total official development assistance envelope, or official development assistance, according to the OECD DAC, is about $135 billion. So the first point to make is that's not enough to solve the global challenges that we face. So where is the innovative finance going to come from? Well, compare those numbers in the kind of $100 billion range with the world GDP of $85 trillion. And of that world GDP of $85 trillion, about half of that, as of last year, comes from emerging and developing countries. So one place the innovative finance has to come from is from domestic sources themselves, domestic resource mobilization. And I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I can tell, what we should be looking for there is something like IRS auditors without borders to complement, the MSF crowd, because it really is about domestic taxation and the political will to keep those difficult systems in place and to invest in social areas. The second place, I think, in terms of innovative finance would be the investment bankers without borders, because there's about $210 trillion of private capital in savings. A lot of that is in pension funds and insurance companies. And probably of that 210, at least $2 or $3 trillion that is sitting on the sidelines in terms of socially oriented investors who are waiting for the channels to do it, be it an investment fund, be it a development impact bond, kind of blended finance. So first point I wanted to make is bringing an innovation lens to that whole picture. In terms of official development assistance, and that's critical, and I'm suggesting it increase, we're really talking in the range of tens of billions to $100 billion. But in terms of domestic countries, we're talking in the trillions, and in terms of private sector capital, we're talking in the trillions. So that reminds me of the old joke by the bank robber Willie Sutton, which is, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. I'm suggesting that in terms of innovative finance, that's the way we should think about it. Second point I want to make, just very briefly, Dean, on innovation, is we've never really taken a considered prospective approach to, let's say, development assistance, $130 billion. How much of that should be spent on innovation, new ways of doing things, and how much of that should be spent on just expanding and taking to scale the things we already know work, a point that Keith made? If you were a $130 billion company, you would both exploit new things, because you need that R&D to ensure your survival in the future. Explore new things, because you need that R&D to ensure your survival in the future. And you would exploit your existing technologies to increase your revenues. We never really make that explicit thought, and we should. Why? Because in the short term, the innovation can't compete with the programs, because most of the outcomes in the programs happen during the life of the program. Gavi is a great cause. You put $1 million into Gavi or $1 billion into Gavi, you know what will happen in the next 3 years. You put $1 billion into preterm birth innovation or any of these other things, you don't know what will happen in the next 3 years. But if the innovation is successful and it's transformative, the outcomes will happen after 3 years or after 5 years, and that gift will keep giving. So that's why I think we actually need to have an explicit conversation about what percentage of development assistance should be for explore innovation, and what percentage should be for exploit. And I would define, just in closing, innovation very broadly. Science and technology innovation, social innovation, including health system delivery innovations, business innovations, integrating them together. And I'd love to hear a little bit of conversation about kind of making that explicit thing. If we even decided end of today that we thought, 10 minutes left, so I'll take 10%. If we even decided just today, why don't we take 10% of the $131 billion and say that will be an innovation, because the spending in innovation probably is a little bit lower than 10% now. I would guess it's probably in the 4 to 5% range, but not 100% sure. Let's study that. Let's come up with an explicit prescription, and that would actually help very much domestic countries like Canada, like the United States, face that difficult trade-off, because political timelines are short-term, and you're looking for those short-term results. It's a lot harder to support things where the results come a little bit later, but critical because if you think things are fine now with 6.3 million kids dying and 300,000 women dying, then you don't need innovation. If you don't think things are fine, you do need innovation, but actually getting to those decisions is very difficult, I think, for domestic decision makers for the reasons we described. So, Dean, innovation and a couple of different takes on it. Fireside Channel, at Peter A. Singer, over to you.
Great. And one of the major institutions involved in scientific innovation in health in the world, obviously, is the NIH. So let's get your take, Roger.
Let me think a little bit further than the here and now. I'm looking down at Jaime and Hailey. You guys have caused an epidemic here. I would never have thought 10 years ago, Hailey, that we would be sitting in this fabulous room on a brand new campus with a couple hundred people here, all of whom want to do global health. And Jaime, I met you 30 years ago or so when you were a student, and who would have ever thought that that investment in you 30 years would have led to $100 million? So I'm thinking long term. And when I think long term, I'm investing in people and I'm investing in research, much of which is long term, except that the people who will be doing that innovation and research are all of you out here. So this center, I'm so delighted to be here because you are really making the future happen in ways that we can't count. You know, Einstein had this quote, many of the things we count don't count. And many of the things that we count don't count, and many things that count can't be counted. I don't know how to put an economic value on what you've done for this Center for Global Health here. I know it's enormous, like pornography. I know it's enormous, but I don't know how to measure it. And I think that. So my first point is that while we think about investments in global health, I think perhaps the best investment and the investment which will give us the greatest return in the long term is what you have done right here at this center. And I know, Hailey, 10 years ago this was a vision, a crazy idea that now has morphed into something absolutely incredible. Now the second point I want to make is that when I first got to Fogarty, there was a crazy economist named Dean Jameson who delivered the Disease Control Priority Project, and I came just as that was launched. I have no part of it. But part of what he said was that with life expectancy getting longer, and now it's 70 years, we have to begin to invest in the non-communicable diseases. And one thing that I learned when we got there was that the investments that Fogarty has made in training people in research in HIV have paid back time and time again. And the research was not done by Americans. It was done by Africans, by partnerships, by collaborations. But it's led to the ability to think of a generation without AIDS, so that the PEPFAR program that Eric Goosby ran could not have been done without the research basis. I would also say that in terms of innovation, we have no monopoly on brains in the United States. I only have to look down to see a surgeon from Eritrea, an epidemiologist from Mexico, a sanitarian from the UK, an economist. We have sapped the brains of others to make innovation happen. And some of that innovation is in areas outside of the infectious disease area. When I look at the NIH campus, and I think when Francis Collins came in, we discussed this, The issue was where to invest, and he put global health on his radar as one of the pillars. When I spoke to his advisory committee the first time, I touted the great investments we had made in HIV and how that investment in research and people had led to all the great discoveries that have been made in HIV treatment, PMTCT, and the like. At the same time, after my talk, a fabulously beautiful woman came up to me, 1999 Miss America, Nicole Johnson, and she said, you know, if a child in Africa has HIV, they can be identified and treated for life. He says, I'm Miss America. I did my bathing suit routine with an insulin pump. And if a child in Africa has diabetes, there's nothing there for them. And the NCD agenda is something we have to deal with. And HIV is important in Africa, but with life expectancy at 70, the NCD agenda is on us. Where do we have people? Where are those researchers who are going to deal with the global NCD agenda? We really don't have them. We don't have many cardiologists that thought globally, diabetologists, cancer people, bioengineers. And this is where investments in innovation in the future will also come. So I would say that another area of a major investment has got to be there. Now, as I look at this center that you've created, Jaime, it hasn't been created, and I know Hiley came to me when I first got there, and he lost an NIH grant, and I felt so apologetic. This center has been built not only with NIH funding, but with private funding, with public-private partnerships, with donor funding. And I think the future of funding envelope is not to say we need to take away from one and give to the other. It's to recognize that research anywhere will help people everywhere. And we're doing our best research on Alzheimer's today among populations in Colombia who have a high prevalence of a single gene that makes HIV, Alzheimer's occur young and with rapid expression. We've done lots that we can do globally that we can't do at home. So the frontiers of science tomorrow, today, are going to be overseas. So in closing, I think that we have opportunities that we need to invest in research and in the next generation of researchers. We need to expand our global health and the global health funding envelope, not only to the infectious diseases and HIV and Ebola that are critical, but to the NCD agenda as well. And I can only look out here and smile at all these young faces who are going to be the beneficiaries of this Center for Global Health here at UCSF. You guys have made an absolutely enormous, game-changing contribution. And I think with Dean here, I have to say, it's got to be economically profitable for San Francisco and the San Francisco area and the state of California. Thank you so much.
Well, I think we've heard two different but quite complementary perspectives on innovation and science, on the need for financing those capacities, the research capacities, the knowledge generation capacities, the next generation, and to seek finance in a broad range in the private sector as well as the public sector, and for particularly the new ideas and new knowledge that will be, I'm convinced, have been a key driver of the improvements in global health and will likely continue to be. There are other dimensions of global finance that Gavin Yamey and some of his colleagues here at UCSF have been contracted by Gates to express and explore. The global leadership function, the global advocacy function, the control of the cross-border externalities, the types of things that Ramanan spoke about this morning, all of which, quite separate from the research function, are nonetheless very much functions that require global finance. Our time is up, so I think I'll leave it at that, and with Roger's challenge to all of the young people here, not only to enjoy the opportunities that have been created, but to create the opportunities for the generation that follows them. Let me ask you all to please stay. George Rutherford will be taking the next session now, and so we will proceed to that. Thank you very much, Roger, Peter. Thank you, David.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.